Earlier this year, the director of the Iowa Department of Education unveiled recommendations from a state task force. The goal? To improve education, in part through getting better teachers. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this hour we'll talk with several people about how to improve education in the state, including Linda Fandel, the Special Assistant for Education to Iowa Governor Terry Branstad. We'll also hear from two faculty members at Iowa State School of Education about their national recognition for preparing science teachers. Before that, views on science education from ISU's Tom Barton, who has been elected President-elect of the American Chemical Society. That's all coming up. First, a look at this hour's news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and my first guest today is Tom Barton, a distinguished chemist with long ties to Iowa State University and the U.S. Department of Energy's Ames Laboratory. He's just been elected president-elect of the American Chemical Society. The American Chemical Society, with more than 164,000 members, is the world's largest scientific society. Tom Barton has been at ISU since 1967, a distinguished professor since 1984. He directed the Ames Laboratory from 1988 to 2007, and from 1998 to 2007, he directed Iowa State's Institute for Physical Research and Technology. He retired from Iowa State in May of this year. He's currently an Iowa State Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Chemistry and an associate at the Ames Laboratory, joining us for the first few minutes of today's program in our Ames studio. Tom Barton, welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Ben. I'm happy to be here and happier not to be where you are.
Congratulations during your run for the president of the American Chemical Society. You said that if you were elected, you would want to improve science, technology, engineering, and math education, also known as STEM, a topic that we're talking about this hour in the U.S. What are some of the major issues, in your opinion, that are hindering American school children from being as successful as their overseas counterparts in these areas?
Well, not surprisingly, education is and will be a focus of mine in my 3 years in the presidential succession of the American Chemical Society. And I'm happy then to provide you with some continuity to both halves of your program this noon. My focus on education is not going to be in the colleges and universities. I should say that right off. There I don't really see huge problems, really significant concerns. We're still our upper-level education in America is the gold standard of the world, and that's as evidenced by the many criteria, and especially the presumed value of the American degree by the students who flock to our universities from all over the world. And I would point out, though, that I'm constantly amazed at the people who keep saying over and over and bleating that America needs more scientists. Now, this idea just won't die despite frequent debunking. We have more scientists right now than we have jobs, so we need to look at that from both sides of the equation. But drifting to K through 12, where I really do have a lot of concerns, and all the international competitions and decades of national reports from blue ribbon committees, they tell us over and over that we're doing very, very poorly in that arena, K through 12 science education.
Why?
Well, first thing I would say is we don't celebrate it. We don't celebrate achievement in K through 12 science education in the United States. We need to do everything we can. Of course, science bowls, various awards, news coverage, and so on. Perhaps make it seem at least as important as scoring a touchdown or nailing a three-pointer at the buzzer. Secondly, we need to require students to work harder and longer. Yep. That's what we might call...
There's a big follow-up there. How for that one, right?
Well, it's already being done. I call it the Asian approach. There is really no rational reason for having a three-month vacation every year. This is not training you for life. Life is not filled with three-month vacations every year. A South Korean high school graduate, same age as an American high school graduate, has gone to school 2 years more than his or her American counterpart. Secondly, and everybody knows this, it was alluded to at the beginning of this program, we need to enhance teacher and teaching quality. We'll call that one the Finnish approach, because in Finland, those who aspire to a professional position in teaching, about 10% of them are successful and 90% are rejected. It is highly, highly difficult to get in.
Mm-hmm. And need, relatively speaking, higher paid in Finland?
No, that's next. Finland has quite a bit higher pay, and there's also the prestige that's associated with being a high school teacher in Finland that we do not have here. So, yeah, much stiffer academic requirements for teachers. Ultimately, I would like to have every teacher of chemistry have a degree in chemistry or have a degree in chemical education. And of course, they need more pay to attract the best people and better conditions. I know firsthand how important a good high school teacher can be. Now, I have always envied my colleagues who were influenced by great high school teachers. They tell me after their high school course, that's all they wanted to be was a high school teacher. I had the most god-awful high school chemistry teacher you can imagine. At least I hope he was the worst in the world. He's a jackleg preacher with a biology degree from some unknown college. And I don't imagine that anybody who ever took a course under that individual imagined going into chemistry as their for their professional life. It is extremely important to have your first association with the arena, the area, to be an intellectually stimulating and pleasant one.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you talked about this. I want to go back to a point. We have a few minutes, 5 minutes or so left, but the point you made about the U.S. really having enough scientists, and is the problem then that being a chemist in the U.S. Is hard because many of these jobs have been outsourced? Tell us about that.
Well, I will. Of course, what area doesn't have problems with unemployment right now? But chemistry is, I hate to use a grammatically incorrect, sort of unique terminology, but we are and have been losing jobs overseas. And people have to stop being in denial about that, in that they are not coming back. Those jobs are gone. The research centers and manufacturing centers and so on in the other countries where those jobs went have been built, and they are staffed, and they are connected with the universities and other institutions in those countries. So we have to replace those jobs here. And that is most easily done by something that America excels in, and that's innovation. We have to find every way we can to celebrate, to initiate, to fertilize whatever innovative and entrepreneurial activities in the United States to create those new jobs. And we need to look for anything that stands in the way of those entrepreneurial activities and their success.
I wonder if you could reflect in the couple minutes we have left on the changes you've seen, because you received your PhD in organic chemistry, Tom Barton, from, I believe, the University of Florida in 1967, retiring this past May from Iowa State University with a distinguished career. What are some of the major changes you've seen in your field, organic chemistry, in those 45 years?
Okay. I'm a physical organic chemist, and in the 1960s, when I was doing my graduate work, if you thought you were hot stuff in organic chemistry, you went into physical organic chemistry. That was the aura associated with it. Today, if you're at a national meeting of the American Chemical Society, and like a quiet place to eat your lunch, look in your program for somebody who's speaking in physical organic chemistry.
Not so hot anymore.
No, not so hot anymore.
Okay.
Is that bad? No, it's not bad. It's not hot anymore because the area reached maturity. Today, all areas of chemistry and biochemistry and chemical engineering utilize the fruits of all the research and work that was done.
Give us some things in my everyday environment that I would thank to physical organic chemistry.
Gee, that might be a little bit tough. I'm thinking of how it's used by other scientists
okay.
in their work. I can't look on the shelf right now and see any physical organic chemistry.
Okay. Give us an idea of some applications that scientists use it for and the future of it then.
Well, nanoscience, very much so, are also optical, organic optoelectronic materials are built and handled through principle physical organic chemistry. But we do not have time here today to get into those details.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you would comment from your perspective on, because you have a lot to do with international spheres and chemistry, also education, if our country is unique in the way that we treat science in our politics, the way we discuss science in our politics, if that fits in anywhere with maybe the challenges we face.
Well, that's a tough. Of course, it's political. Everything is political. The ACS doesn't run on tax dollars, but chemistry certainly, or chemical research certainly does to a large extent. And so that takes us right back to education. We have a continuing job in educating the American public, and that most definitely includes Congress, on the importance of chemistry as an enabling science. And I usually talk about the funding of chemistry, and we're usually talking chemical research there, as an investment. And there are many studies, many, many examples, you see, where our tax dollars went into funding chemical research that produced far more than it cost to get there.
Mm-hmm.
It is most definitely an investment. And if we don't make the proper investments in our sciences in this country, we have no hope of maintaining the status that we have now.
So in your field, physical organic chemistry, you've just said that it used to be a hotter field than it is today. We have about a minute left. Tell if you invest in that, what are you going to get? What could you hope to get from that investment in the future?
Startup companies. Not physical organic chemistry. You invest in chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
Chemistry has taken two definite directions, in addition to many other, but two main directions, is that is toward materials chemistry, and bio-related material. I look at the organic chemists that are coming into our faculty now, and many of them are doing what I would have thought was biochemistry. Of course, biochemists are branching into molecular genetics and so on now. And these fields merge, chemical engineering, chemistry, biochemistry, so on. And it's very, very difficult to see the lines of demarcation.
Mm. Very quickly, young people I know, when they talk about science, they're very, very excited about Bill Nye, the science guy. Are you a fan of his as well? Do you know of him?
I know the name. I think it's something that's on television, right?
Yes, he's a big science guy on PBS.
I actually don't watch television, except for Iowa State sports, that is.
Okay, go Cyclones.
Okay.
Tom Barton, Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Chemistry, President-elect of the American Chemical Society. Thank you so much, sir, for coming into the Ames studio.
Thanks for having me.
This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Improving education in Iowa, our focus this hour. And my next guest is Linda Fandel, a special assistant for education to Iowa Governor Terry Branstad. She's formerly the editorial page editor at the Des Moines Register, where she won national awards for her multi-year project looking at how Iowa and how the nation could have world-class schools. And before that, she covered education issues at the Register for more than two decades for the news and opinion sections. Linda Fandel, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Ben. I'm glad to be here.
Linda, tell me in broad terms what the governor wants to accomplish in terms of education this session.
We know we need to give all Iowa students a world-class education. The governor set out to do that 2 years ago. We made some progress last legislative session. The governor and lieutenant governor are determined to make more progress this session and hope to build an increasingly broad consensus that we've got to transform education in Iowa. We know we've got many great teachers in Iowa. We want to make sure that every student has a great teacher in every classroom and that we provide teachers the support they need to help all students meet higher academic expectations today. It's a knowledge-based economy today, and we've simply got to help all kids get there, not just some kids.
Now, earlier this year, the director of the Iowa Department of Education, Jason Glass, unveiled 13 recommendations from the state's task force on teacher leadership and compensation. The goal here, to improve education in part through getting better teachers. Where would you say Iowa is right now in regards to recruiting new elementary teachers? How would you size that up?
The teacher leadership and compensation task force recommendations were not just about recruiting elementary teachers, but teachers across the board. We want to really elevate the teaching profession and make it a higher status, more respected profession, and we want to improve instruction in every classroom. We have a lot of great teachers in Iowa schools. What we lack is the systemic support for helping students learn more. More than ever is expected of students today. So with higher expectations, we've got to make sure we deliver really high-quality instruction in every classroom across the state.
What would you say are the most crucial recommendations on that list of 13?
We want to raise the beginning teacher salary, the statewide minimum, from the current $28,000 to $35,000 a year to help make teaching a more attractive profession for students coming through college. We want to improve entry into the profession by creating a residency year for all teachers new to the profession that would include a reduced teaching load to allow them to really strengthen their teaching in that first year, which is crucial. And we want to enhance professional opportunities throughout the entire system by combining teacher leadership roles with the principal's instructional leadership role to help improve instruction in every classroom.
Now, in Iowa, going back to the first issue that you raised, in Iowa, the average starting salary for a public school teacher is $28,000. Increasing
that's
teacher...
not the average. That's the statewide minimum. The average is somewhat above that, but the statewide minimum teacher pay is $28,000 a year. We want to raise it to $35,000.
Now, increasing the teacher salary is certainly going to increase the pool of applicants for teaching positions, make them more appealing. Where will this money come from?
We're primarily looking at new revenue as well as repurposing some existing revenue, but the lion's share of the funding will need to be new revenue.
Mm-hmm. Any idea where that new revenue will come from?
Well, increase state revenue. The state is in relatively good financial shape this year, and so we're hoping that some of that money can be used to help strengthen instruction in Iowa's classrooms.
Okay. Now, the director of Iowa Department of Education, Jason Glass, says these 13 recommendations will be the centerpiece of the governor's education proposal to legislators when the session starts here shortly in 2013. How do you anticipate a proposal? I've seen a number of $150 million to improve schools. How is that going to go over in this Iowa legislature?
We're still working on cost models for the governor and lieutenant governor's education reform proposal for the 2013 legislature. Until we get the December revenue estimate and have a chance to see what we can do, because whatever we do, it has to be something that is within our means as a state to do. And so once we get the mid-December revenue estimate, we'll have a better idea of how much money we'll put into that education reform proposal.
So that all depends on what the revenue picture looks like, how aggressive this campaign to improve Iowa education can be.
Sure, that'll play a significant role. Again, we've got to live within our means. The governor and lieutenant governor know we need to invest more in helping get strong instruction in every single classroom in the state. Teachers are being asked to do more than ever before, but we haven't put in place the systemic changes to help them do what's being asked, and which is, all students need to meet high expectations today. They all need to finish high school, college, or career ready in terms of being ready for career training. So we've got to do more to help teachers meet those goals. At the same time, we've got to do it within what we can afford to do as a state.
Mm-hmm. When we look at college graduates recruiting teachers, what's a minimum GPA that we're looking at for Iowa? What are the benchmarks there?
Yeah, we're not proposing a minimum grade point average for admission to teacher preparation programs this session. We did that last session. We proposed a minimum B average. Typically, it's a C average around the state in our 30 or so teacher preparation programs. Some are higher. The University of Iowa is moving to a B average this spring, but we're not proposing a minimum GPA. What we're really focusing on with the governor and lieutenant governor's education reform plan for the 2013 session is helping to strengthen instruction in every classroom.
Mm-hmm. Why no GPA? Because that would seem to be something that would make sense to people that would raise the bar, improve our education by improving the quality of our teachers.
We can't do everything at once, and we think the single most important thing we can do is really professionalized teaching by creating teacher leadership roles so teachers can use their expertise to collaborate and strengthen instruction in classrooms along with building principals.
Mm-hmm. These leadership roles, I understand that the current teachers would become, some of them would become mentors of sorts to new teachers. How would that work?
What we're proposing is a career pathway system. It's got six levels to it. It's got initial teachers, beginning teachers. So then the initial teachers are in their first two or three years in the classroom. The next level is career teachers. That's followed by model teachers, who are career teachers who will open the door to their classrooms to be observed and to work with other teachers. And then there are mentor teachers, lead teachers, and emeritus teachers. And lead and mentor teachers will teach much of the time and also be out across the building much of the time working to help improve instructional strategies, analyze data, coach teachers, co-teach, and strengthen instruction as it needs to be strengthened. You know, we've got many outstanding teachers across Iowa schools. All of them will not want to be mentor and lead teachers, but we're hopeful that many of them will and that we'll be able to spread best practices across buildings in that way.
Mm-hmm. How does that compare, that multi-tier system of mentorship, compare with what we have currently?
Right now we have mentors for new teachers, and that system has been a relatively good system for Iowa. I think we can strengthen it by improving, making sure that every new teacher has a great mentor. Right now, the reports I hear back from new teachers is that it's a mix. Some of them have great mentors, some not so much. We want to have every new teacher have a great mentor, but we also want to provide mentors for veteran teachers who need to strengthen their practice in some way.
Mm-hmm. And finally, much of our show today focuses on education, science education. Governor Branstad selected members of his STEM Advisory Council. We have guests on the show today who criticize the fact that there are no scientists on the committee, even though there are some additional appointees who are our scientists. Can you answer that criticism? No scientists on the STEM Advisory Council.
We've got a great representation from education institutions, pre-K-12 through higher ed, from business and industry, from healthcare, from nonprofits, among other sectors. So we've really got terrific representation, and we'll look as we go forward where we need to, as members' terms expire, where we need to replace different kinds of perspectives and get the best rounded group we can on the STEM Council. But that's a council that really has an extraordinary cross-section of representation, and we'll certainly take a look at that. But I would argue that the state university's representation, as well as Grinnell College and Des Moines Area Community College representation on the STEM Council, are certainly indicative of having a presence from science as well as Kemen and other industry representatives.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that this advisory council that represents science, technology, engineering, and math could, in the future, include scientists. There's room for maneuver there.
I would argue it's scientists are already represented, but we'll certainly, because Gail Wortman, who's a science teacher, is on the executive committee of the STEM Advisory Council. I think science is pretty well represented already, but we'll certainly look at how we could strengthen that.
Linda Fandel, thank you very much for this conversation. Special Assistant for Education to Iowa Governor Terry Branstad. We appreciate your time, Linda.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks for the opportunity.
Coming up in just a moment after a short break, we'll talk about how we best teach science in elementary schools. That's coming up in just a moment when River to River continues. This is Iowa Public Radio. River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking about education in Iowa today. Iowa State University is receiving national recognition for its strength in preparing science teachers who use best practices to improve student learning. Joining us for the remainder of the hour, two faculty members at the Iowa State School of Education, two of three co-authors of a study that will be published by the journal Science Education, coming up in 2013, and also will, in January, receive an award at the meeting of the Association for Science Teacher Education. And joining us, Joanne Olson and Michael Clough. They are both associate professors in the Iowa State University School of Education, joining us in our Ames studio. Professors, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
I want to mention Ben Herman, the other co-author of this study, a former Iowa State PhD student. And let's talk a little bit about what we mean, because this study is about the nature of science. Clue us in as to what that means.
The nature of science addresses questions such as what is science, how does science work, what scientists are like, how science impacts society, and how society impacts science, and many other issues like those. The nature of science has been a target of science education for well over 100 years, and from the 80s on, it's been in all science education reform documents. But we've had difficulty in transforming science classes so that the science is accurately portrayed, what doing science is like is accurately portrayed, and what scientists are like is accurately portrayed.
So the nature of the science has to do in one way with how science is treated in popular culture, how we treat it outside the sphere of scientists.
Very much that's the case. We know that science textbooks misportray much about the nature of science, but we know that the media does also. It gives inaccurate portrayals of both how science is done, scientific knowledge, and also, again, the characteristics of scientists both in their professional lives and in their personal lives.
Found also in textbooks.
Yes, definitely so.
Can you give me an example?
Well, I think...
Joanne.
A good example is a classic portrayal of John Dalton in most chemistry textbooks. He's sitting leaning back against a chair, and there's usually one or two sentences that says that, you know, Dalton was a school teacher and, poof, came up with atomic theory. And that's not at all what happened. He was fully employed not to teach. He actually was such a poor teacher that his kids climbed out of the windows. And so he was fully funded to do science full time, and his ideas developed over decades of work.
Mm-hmm. Why does that matter then in science education, that we understand the nature of science when we teach it?
Some other misconceptions that are portrayed, to answer your question, textbooks convey that scientists follow a method, and that method seems to be very rigorous, straightforward, and that makes science appear to be a career that is not at all something students would want to do. The creative side of science is not accurately portrayed. It looks like scientists simply are slaves to the data. Mm-hmm. And other misconceptions that are portrayed in science classes is that data tells scientists what to think, and data has to be interpreted. We invent ideas to account for data. This is why Einstein often remarked that in science, imagination is more important than knowledge.
So give me an example. Let's say I am one of these people who, because of my limited knowledge, I'm straitjacketed into thinking science is not creative. What will you counter that with? What example can you tell me?
There are myriad examples of the creativity in science. One of the things I want to point out is that this misconception has caused individuals to avoid majoring in science because they perceive science as not being creative. Mm-hmm. And the very interpretation of data, how you develop tests of ideas, these all require the creative thinking of the scientist.
Another way that this causes students to misunderstand science is portrayed as if data leads to ideas. And oftentimes, in fact, most often, ideas have to be accounted for data. There's a number of science ideas that if you don't really understand the nature of science, you cannot have a deep understanding of the science content itself. Pendulum motion is an excellent example of this. If you really follow Galileo's work, he is idealizing the natural world. He's talking about point masses. He's talking about pendulum without strings. He's talking about no friction. And your typical student would wonder, why is he doing that? And understanding the nature of science helps understand how scientists go about their work and why they go about their work the way they do. And in doing so, it makes the science content more interesting. It makes it more easy to understand, and it casts science and scientists in a very interesting light.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we've talked a little bit about the nature of science, a key part of your study. What did you look at then in your study that focused on the nature of science?
One of the important parts about our study is we followed graduates of our program in their second to fifth year of teaching. And so what this means is we're finding out more about what their practices really are. Some teachers go out perhaps and try to implement things they have come to understand about research-based science teaching practices, and then they may try it, they may falter. So we were interested in following our graduates 2 to 5 years out to see what they're doing, long after they've graduated from our program. And what we found is that of the teachers we followed, which was as best we could a representative sample of our program, that of the 13, all addressed the nature of science to at least some extent, but 9 did so at very encouraging levels, both accurately addressed the nature of science and effectively taught the nature of science. And of the 4 who were in the lower group, 3, again, were doing it, just not, of course, the levels we'd like to see. But the fact that 9 of 13 were doing it pretty high levels is very encouraging, particularly since the research has been clear. It's been very hard to get teachers to accurately and effectively teach the nature of science while they're teaching science.
Now, incorporating the nature of science into the classroom is, as you say, widely cited as an important part of students' education in science, a best practice by policymakers pushing for education reform. How widely, in fact, nationwide, have teachers effectively implemented this practice?
Only about 6% of teachers nationwide receive any coursework in the nature of science during their teacher education program. We've seen a severe decline nationwide in professional development opportunities for teachers in science because of emphasis on language arts and mathematics. And because those two areas are tested and reported under No Child Left Behind requirements, teachers aren't getting the support that they need to teach the nature of science. So while it is in all of the science education reform documents, and we know that this is important in order to recruit strong, creative people into STEM fields, teachers receive very, very little support nationwide to do this.
So you're saying that No Child Left Behind is an enemy of science education?
Absolutely. We're seeing this both the secondary and the elementary levels, not only in terms of professional development, but in elementary, No Child Left Behind has been devastating for science, social studies, art, music, PE, and even recess in many areas. 78% of teachers nationwide reported that due to No Child Left Behind, science education had diminished dramatically in their schools, with 1/3 of elementary teachers reporting in 2006 that they don't teach science at all. Mm. This situation has gotten even worse. So it's not a priority, and yet our nation talks about how we want science education, we want folks to go into STEM fields. And yet the first 7 years of a child's education, science is completely taken a backseat.
So what have been the implications of having not enough, as you say, 6% nationwide, nature of science in scientific education? What do we see further on as children grow up, become adults, get careers?
What we find is that the misconceptions that are so prevalent do play out in a number of ways. We've talked about how it impacts students' attitudes towards science education, towards learning science content, and towards thinking of science as a career. But it also has impacts on socio-scientific decision-making. There's been research done recently that points to how misunderstandings of how science is done causes policymakers and also citizens to downplay the extensive evidence in favor that global climate change is real. Mm-hmm. They wrongly think that scientists always follow this step-by-step method, experimental, there has to be a controlled treatment, and so they aren't able to understand how good science is in other areas. For instance, if you actually hold that good science has to be experimental and that there has to be a controlled treatment, you can eliminate entire fields of research, astronomy, paleontology, large areas of ecology. There's just a great deal of science research that for good reasons, does not follow the stereotypical view of how science works. And this results in poor policymaking decisions.
So you see a real connection between educating science educators and when you turn on your nightly news or listen to NPR and you hear about the controversy over the degree to which humans are contributing to climate change or not.
Precisely. Citizens who deeply understand the nature of science are in a much better position to make reasoned decisions about what experts have to say about global climate change and other socio-scientific issues.
Joanne, I understand your emphasis is on elementary studies, where a big issue is getting elementary school teachers to teach science. Talk about that a little bit, because what needs to be fixed? What's the remedy?
Well, I think in this testing climate, if science education truly is valued, it needs to be tested and it needs to matter. The problem we run into there is how do we develop good tests that go after things that we really want from kids? One of the challenges that we've had since No Child Left Behind has been in our desire to assess students in reading and mathematics. The tests that have been produced have gone after very low-level knowledge because that's the kind of assessments that you can give on a grand scale at a reasonable cost. The result has been that that drives instruction. It's very, very difficult to get elementary teachers to teach science because helping them have enough science content courses as an undergraduate when they're going through their teacher education programs, helping them have sufficient coursework in science methods so that they know how to teach it, and then having ongoing professional development are all crucial. But when we aren't funding schools well enough where they can afford science equipment, when it's not part of the school day, when it's devalued, this becomes a very crucial issue that has to be looked at from multiple facets. We need many aspects of society working together on this problem. So it's not just a teacher education problem. It's not just a school resource issue problem. You know, we need partnerships with the Science Center of Iowa, for example, with other institutions that are doing informal education. We need parents. We need the public to get involved and push for children's science education. We need parents who are asking their kids not just what's your reading score, but what are you learning in science and how is that impacting you? And helping parents understand that getting their kids out in nature is a crucial thing that they can do to help their kids better understand science later on. They need to understand, you know, where is the moon during the day? Where is it at night? Why is it that sometimes we can actually see the moon during the day? These are the sorts of things that when kids aren't spending time out in nature, we're losing that connect. And those natural experiences are what the rest of our science education is built on.
Right. And a lot of things trending the other way to keep us, keep our young people behind screens indoors, not asking these grand questions of nature.
Yeah, there was a really nice study done where a child responded to an interviewer and said, I like to play indoors better because that's where all the outlets are.
We put on our Facebook the question, how do school science programs engage you or your child? We want to know from you, River to River listeners, how do the science programs engage you or your child? Or what do you think they could do better? You can also call us, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Joanne Olson and Michael Clough with us, two associate professors at the Iowa State University School of Education, co-authors of a new study published to be published in the journal Science Education. An answer to our Facebook post from spring, the answer, a good teacher makes more of a difference than any subject, program, or materials could ever do. Comment on that.
It's certainly the case. Research is overwhelmingly supporting the idea that the teacher is what matters most in school science education. And yet, producing a highly qualified, competent teacher is very complex, very difficult, demands a lot of things. It demands that they have a very strong understanding of science content. My colleague and I are worried about how there are licensure requirements that ignore the evidence that content matters. The teachers need to be competent in their science content areas. It requires a teacher who understands pedagogy. It's a mistake to think that effective teachers simply know their content well. If that were the case, then we would have exceptionally good teachers at all universities, and we know that is not always the case. So content matters, pedagogy matters, and preparing a teacher that understands how children learn and all those other things, it takes a great deal of time and effort. And so we're also very much bewildered by attempts at times to circumvent what we know about preparing highly effective science teachers.
Circumvent how? In what ways have we seen that, in your opinion?
Well, let me give you some examples. And I know the policymakers have perhaps their, you know, the best intention in mind. We know that we have a hard time getting teachers for particular subject areas in certain areas of the state. And so, for instance, they have this what's called a all-science endorsement, where if you have 24 credit hours in one science area, let's say biology, and if you have 12 credits in chemistry, 12 in physics, and 12 in the earth sciences, that you are now endorsed to teach all subjects. Well, imagine a teacher teaching chemistry with only 12 credits under their belt. That's about three courses, sometimes only two courses. They're not going to be in a position to teach science effectively. They don't know the content well enough. You certainly wouldn't want them doing inquiry chemistry laboratory experiences. You could hurt a child with that little science content understanding. And so in one sense, you know, again, we have a shortage of science teachers, and yet they pass policies that ensure that some teachers are not going to be qualified to teach certain subjects very well. So that's one issue that's very important. There's also the downplaying of effective, and I want to make clear this point, effective science teacher education programs. We know that there are ineffective ones, but policymakers tend to, lump them all together. And here at Iowa State, we have created an extensive science teacher education program. We have evidence that it makes a difference, but policymakers tend to deal with generalities.
Okay. Let's go to Matt in Cedar Rapids. We have a few minutes left, but Matt, what's on your mind? Matt, are you there?
Hello?
Yes, Matt, we can hear you. Go ahead. Can you hear us?
Yeah, I would just like to say that my kids get little to no science in their education at the elementary level because it's all reading and math based, and it would be pretty easy to implement reading and math into science, but the teachers have their hands tied because they can't measure reading or aren't able to have the tools to measure reading through science and math, and what little science, it's just done as lip service to the curriculum.
And that concerns you. Have you done anything, reacted in any way to your particular school, teachers?
Well, I mean, we help at home with our kids, but, you know, the teachers, they're doing what they're told, and every
right.
school teaches everything the same thing.
Matt, thank you for that. Let's get comment from that from Michael or Joanne.
Yeah, I think we have to realize that, you know, children are more than test scores, and that when we make these policies, you know, we want kids to be literate. That's very, very important. We know that. But when we set up systems under the name of accountability where we start testing kids all the time, we've turned schools into what one author called read-aside. You know, we can increase test scores, but we can do it at such an extent that kids then hate to read. And we have to realize that schools are more about just getting kids to pass tests. We want kids who are innovative. We want kids who are cutting-edge thinkers, who are on the front edge of providing that intellectual capital that we need. We want kids who have a strong well-being, solid nutrition, health, safety, overall happiness. There are a lot of things that can be done in schools that can educate the whole child, including a science education. But in our narrow focus on these narrow test scores and two subject matters, language arts and math, I really think we're losing something very important here.
We started this discussion by talking about having you explain the nature of science. I wonder if we can talk about how that's been treated with some historical perspective. Michael, do you have an idea there that you can clue us in the context in which we're discussing how science is taught to our young kids today?
Well, when students, for instance, are subjected to cookbook laboratory activities where they simply follow directions, you can see that there's not a lot of creativity there. The decisions are made for students, so they don't see science as decision-making. And then they're asked to write up their laboratory experience in a traditional format, which all implies there is this step-by-step scientific method. And so you can see why that portrays science as not very appealing. Let me share an example that what I did with my kids when I was teaching high school several years ago. I would have my students take part in an inquiry laboratory activity, and this went on for about 3 days. And when they were all done, or I should say while they were doing the activity, I had them keep a journal. And the journal had to include everything they thought about, the discussions they had, where ideas came from, ideas that were abandoned, everything that went on in their minds and what they did in the class, what they did outside of the class related to this inquiry. Well, in the end, I did have them turn in a laboratory write-up, your traditional write-up, but it was for a very specific purpose. I had the students compare their journal to this laboratory report that they wrote up. And what they clearly saw is that the laboratory report didn't capture any, really, of the, you know, the true nature of what they did. It was just very much fabricated. Now, they could wrongly think, well, this is just them in their school science, and real scientists, you know, of course, follow a step-by-step scientific method. So I then had them read an abridged portion of a paper called Is the Scientific Paper a Fraud? It was written by Peter Medawar, a Nobel laureate, and he was not talking about scientists cheating. He was talking about scientific papers and the way they're written and how those papers are written for a very specific reason, which is to communicate to their colleagues very specific things, but not to communicate how science is really done. And what he said was, the way scientific papers are written does not accurately convey how science is really done. So my students then had the experience in the class, their journals to reflect on, compare that to the lab report they wrote up, and they could see there was a discrepancy, and they could see a authentic scientist saying, yes, that's because the papers are not like how science is really done. What they wrote in their journals is how science is how it's really done.
In closing, we have a few seconds left to tell us about the blog that both you contribute to. It's called storybehindscience.org. What do people find there?
They'll find stories of scientists doing their work, and we've tried hard not to feature just one scientist, but scientists in their work, because we want to convey accurately that scientists collaborate. The effort is an NSF-supported project to help students learn science content, key science ideas. Each story is directed at important science ideas. And while they're learning that content, to understand what doing science is like, what scientists are like, these stories were written at for the post-secondary level. We've got a lot of research that's been very effective towards that, and now we're submitting an NSF grant to move these to the secondary school level.
Michael Clough and Joanne Olson on the faculty at the Iowa State University School of Education. Thank you for joining us this half hour.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden. Production assistance today from Caitlin Fry. In Ames, help from Jason Burns, the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, Catherine Perkins. Our theme music written and performed by the River Monks. Tomorrow on this program, tomorrow at this time, we'll look at Egypt, the protests continuing in advance of voting on a new constitution. Also, why NATO fears the Syrian president may use chemical weapons. Join us tomorrow. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks for joining us.